as I said, I am 77 and by choice I never married. So it is certain, and you wouldn't believe the prejudice there was years ago. It's bad enough now. Oh. But, you know, try 1950s, 1960s, a cisgender heterosexual woman saying, I don't want a husband, was just unheard of.
Totally.
In the very conservative background in which I grew up. However, I was never moved to do anything about it until they tried to kill me. That got my attention.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
Hi, I'm Joan Delfatore. I am a very happily single woman, always single woman, for quite some time. I'm 77, and this is Sylvia and Me.
Joan, thank you so much for being here today. This is going to be fantastic. Your full name is Dr. Joan Delfatore. You're an author, you're a speaker, and your passion, your focus is on the underlying biases for single people, especially when looking for medical care.
Exactly.
And you did a TED Talk back in 2017, and I love the name of it, Sick While Single, Don't Die of Discrimination. I know that when I go into any doctor's office, now I am single now, and I'm very happily single, but I have been married twice. I do have children. I have two. They're in their 30s. But I know that when I go into a doctor's office, any doctor, whether it's an obstetrician, whether it's the eye doctor, the dentist, the GP, you get a form. And on that form, there are boxes, multiple choice. Are you widowed? Are you married? Are you single? And the best, especially here in Connecticut, are you in a domestic partnership? Considering they don't recognize them, why, you know, it's an old form. And a few years ago, after I got divorced, I was divorced for 2 or 3 years or something, I'm thinking myself, what's the difference whether I'm divorced or not? What's the difference whether I'm married? I know I'm not widowed because I did not lose a spouse. And, you know, on all the forms, they ask for an emergency contact. They ask for your insurance information. So the two pieces that are exceedingly important is how they're going to get paid, and God forbid something happens, who can they contact? Why they need the other information other than data gathering is beyond me. So I want to ask you why that title on the TED Talk, TEDx, Single, Sick While Single, Don't Die of Discrimination. And then you also wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine, Death by Stereotype. Can you explain?
First, I had one thought about what you were saying about domestic partners. Even if they're not legally recognized, I will bet you that what they want to know is what your social support system is as they define it. As you know, much of my writing is about the mistake in assuming that social support and whether you have a spouse or a live-in partner are exactly the same thing.
It's not
exactly coextensive. But I will bet you they're asking about a domestic partner because they want to know if you're living with someone in terms of, is there somebody in the home who's going to be able to care for you? Because they're assuming that if someone is in the home, they're capable of caring for you and they are willing to care for you, which, as we know, is not always a universal assumption. And they, much of my work is about the fact they're also, some doctors are also assuming if you don't have a live-in partner, you don't have social support. And we all know that is not true.
No, I mean, people have friends, people have family, maybe not close, but yes, there are some people who are totally alone. You know, that's just the reality, but that's not the majority of the people. And you know, if doctors don't ask and don't start asking their patient about themselves and just assume, and that's what happens. They go by the book. There's certain questions they need to ask. So let's go into why and how, what happened to you because you ran up against this basic discrimination and assumption in a way that is scary.
Well, as I said, I am 77 and by choice I never married. So it is certain, and you wouldn't believe the prejudice there was years ago. It's bad enough now. Oh. But, you know, try 1950s, 1960s, a cisgender heterosexual woman saying, I don't want a husband, was just unheard of.
Totally.
In the very conservative background in which I grew up. However, I was never moved to do anything about it until they tried to kill me. That got my attention. What happened was, this is now in 2011, I was diagnosed with stage 4 gallbladder cancer with metastases in the liver. There are only about 3,000 cases in the whole country of gallbladder cancer each year. The survival rate for all stages of gallbladder cancer put together is 2%. That's the 2 to 5 year survival rate. Mine was stage 4, for which the survival rate is essentially zero. And one of the problems is that surgery is considered inappropriate if the point of origin was the gallbladder because of the assumption that it's just going to come roaring right back. So that was my first encounter with prejudice in the medical community, not about my being single, that came later, but they wanted to just put me on chemo that they knew wasn't going to do anything. The median life expectancy at stage 4 was about 6 months, and with chemo. The chemo wasn't going to do anything for that. Because of the assumption that was largely untested, oh, gallbladder cancer just kills everybody, no point in doing surgery. So I found someone to do the surgery, but then I needed a chemotherapy for follow-up. And it was very important that the chemotherapy had to be state-of-the-art, cutting-edge, the best stuff they had, because I barely had a chance to stay alive at that point. I couldn't fool around. So I was being treated at Sloan Kettering in New York. That's where the surgery was. The medical oncologist at Sloan Kettering said, why don't we see if you can find someplace closer to home to be treated? I live in Delaware, so it's about an hour and a half on the train to get to New York. So I went to a well-known, highly regarded medical oncologist in an institution closer to Delaware, and he really got on a tear about my family situation. He said, you have no husband? No. You have no sons? You have no daughters? You have no brothers? You have no sisters? Are your parents living? I mean, he was really intent on this. And when I said no to everything, he said, then how will you manage? So I started to explain about the friends and extended family who had been very supportive through the surgery. I wasn't guessing that I had social support. I knew I had more social support than many married people get from their spouse. It may be that the spouse themselves they're sick, they're old, they have dementia, whatever. You can't assume a spouse can do everything. So I tried to explain this to this doctor. I couldn't even finish the sentence. He interrupted me in the middle of the sentence and said that he would give me gemcitabine, which is a mild drug. And I knew that wasn't the standard of care. The standard of care was gemcitabine plus a platinum drug, which is much stronger and has much worse side effects. So I said, and we had already established I had no health issues that would have been a problem with this. So I said to him, well, why not also a platinum drug? And you could tell he wasn't happy with the question. He said, oh, no, I wouldn't risk the side effects of that with somebody in your situation. So
your situation?
My situation. We talked some more. It was obvious he thought he was doing the right thing for what he saw as this poor, isolated, helpless person, you know, probably up to my knees in cats. And he thought that by withholding the drug that had much worse side effects, that he was actually doing the right thing for me. So when I realized I wasn't going to get anywhere with him, I went back to Sloan Kettering, and the medical oncologist there gave me the state-of-the-art chemo. There was actually a PS to that later on. She was the lead author on a number of articles. One of them, a couple of them, were in the New England Journal of Medicine, showing that certain genetic mutations cause the platinum drug that I was given to work a lot better than you would expect. So I wasn't in the studies, but just out of curiosity, she took samples from me. I do have some of the genetic mutations that made that drug work much better than you would expect. So to the extent that I survived, in part, because after the surgery had cleared out the bulk of the cancer, and there was relatively little left in terms of microscopic cancer in the bloodstream, the fact that I have genetic mutations that made that drug work especially well for me may be the reason I didn't have a recurrence, that it managed to mop up the rest. So if that is the case, then his wanting to withhold it because he was convinced that I couldn't handle the side effects, that I wouldn't have the social support, could have made the difference in terms of whether I survived or not. So after I recovered, I couldn't let it go. You can see how something like that would really stick with you. I couldn't let it go. I kept thinking, what would happen to a single person who went to an oncologist and didn't know what they were supposed to get? Because the way he said it, the way he said, I'll give you gemcitabine, it sounded as if that's what he would have said to anyone. He gave me no indication that he was treating me any differently, that he was in effect under-treating me. So I got to thinking, what would happen to a single person if they didn't know that? And the other thing is, I had no way of knowing at that point whether he was an outlier, whether maybe this was just, he was just an oddball and maybe this didn't happen often, because the oncologist at Sloan Kettering did give me the appropriate chemotherapy, and she had no problem with the fact that my support system was non-family.
So this oncologist at Sloan Kettering knew that you were single, you had no immediate family, but you had a huge support system.
Right, and she asked the right questions, and so did the surgeon. Both of them, neither one of them asked the questions that that other oncologist did. Do you have a husband? Do you have a sons? Do you have daughters? Rather, what the two at Sloan Kettering asked was, who will give you rides when you can't drive? Who will bring meals if you need them to do that? Those are the right questions. And they had no problem with, as long as it's a competent adult. I have cousins who live close to New York City who had been there every day when I was in the hospital after the surgery. They visited every day. So I think that was another thing that made that medical oncologist feel more comfortable, knowing that I had family nearby that I was close to emotionally, even though they're not technically immediate family. You know, and I think this is what you were getting at before when you were talking about the checkboxes at the doctor's office. We need to get away from the cut and dried assumptions that our society has, that immediate family means support, extended family like cousins don't count. I'm closer to my cousins than a lot of people are to their siblings.
Well, there are people who are closer to their friends than they are to any member of their family. And the thing is, just because you checked off a box that said you had a spouse doesn't mean that that spouse wants to, is capable of taking care. And as you said, it's the box. It's a box that's checked off, and it's just starting where doctors, there are some doctors who are learning that they need to, that it's important to talk to their patient, to learn about their patient, to communicate with their patient. There is such a stigma and such an assumption about single people. I talked to a woman the other day who, what she ran into was a doctor not wanting to tell her something because why add something else on to a woman who's pregnant?
Right.
And it could have, her knowledge could have saved her a lot of pain and agony and so on and so forth. So the systemic undertreatment of single patients, you started doing a deep dive, as you started to say. What exactly, what were you looking for We know that they collect this information. I think as you're talking, we kind of have a feeling as to what they probably assume from that information.
Exactly. What happened was there is a database that's maintained by the National Cancer Institute. It's called the Surveillance Epidemiology and End Results Program, and it's abbreviated SEER, S-E-E-R. SEER right now has about, it was created in the 1970s as part of President Richard Nixon's war on cancer. It now has the records of about 10 million people who were treated for cancer in the United States. You can search it by marital status. It classifies people by their marital status at the time they were diagnosed, and you can cross-reference that with things like their age, the stage of cancer, their insurance status. They don't have individual income levels, but they have neighborhood zip codes where they approximate income levels. So you can cross-reference with all of the other things or many of the other things that might be relevant. And you can also cross-reference what treatment did the patient receive? Did the patient survive? And if they did not survive, did they die of their cancer or of something else? They do not track chemotherapy, or they have a separate area where they track chemo, because chemo is given in outpatient settings where it's much harder to keep track. So mainly what they track in SEER is surgery and radiotherapy. At the time I started doing the research, the first big article I wrote was for the Washington Post, for the health, their weekly health section. At the time I did the research, there were 84 articles. There are now well over 100 refereed medical articles. In other words, these are in peer-reviewed, legitimate medical journals that are indexed on what's called Medline. It's the database of essentially respectable medical journals. There were 84 at the time. On the subject of the relationship between marital status and cancer outcomes, all of them showed that they were all based on SEER. All of them were based on data from SEER. All of them showed that people who are married, someone who shows up with a current spouse, is more likely to survive cancer than an otherwise similar patient, same kind of cancer, same level of cancer, same stage, yada, yada. If you're married, you're more likely to survive than if you are not married. And that whether you're single, divorced, widowed, never married, whatever. Well, these same medical articles hypothesized that the reason is the social support you get from your spouse. There were a lot of big newspaper articles, including the New York Times, shame on the New York Times, but they covered these stories with headlines like marriage helps you survive cancer. But when I dug into the article, another data point that they reported that nobody paid attention to, it was very significantly more likely that you would get surgery or radiotherapy if you were married than if you were not married. So, gee golly, I wonder if that has anything to do with the survival rate.
Life-altering, life-surviving.
Yeah,
surgeries.
You've got cancer and they don't do surgery versus you've got cancer and they do. Golly, I wonder which one is more likely to survive. So that was the basis of the piece that I wrote for the Washington Post. And I was able to interview some of the authors of these medical articles. And they, again, they're like the oncologist I had encountered. They honestly believe that, and they say in these highly prestigious medical articles, they say to the rest of the profession that you're actually doing the right thing for the single person, not to give them surgery or radiotherapy. They can't handle it. They don't have the social support. Some of them even say they don't have the will to live. They don't have anything to live for. Four of the articles that I found use the expression fighting spirit. They don't have a fighting spirit because they don't have anything to live for. Now, these authors have excellent credentials on oncology. They don't know diddly squat about psychology. They don't know anything about sociology. And yet they're pontificating about things they know nothing about, as if social issues require no special training, no special expertise. It's just a matter of opinion. And I'm a big shot doctor, so my opinion matters. So after I did the Washington Post piece, I then pitched a piece to the New England Journal of Medicine, because what I was thinking was, I am a retired professor of English and legal studies. I have no background in medicine. So no matter what I find, no matter how compelling the evidence, no matter how real it is, people could easily just say, well, what does she know? So what I needed was a place that had enough prestige that if the editors of that journal would accept the piece, if the peer reviewers for that journal would pass the piece, then it would have the credibility that I by myself would not have. So I did some research and found that the New England Journal of Medicine has the highest impact factor in the field. The impact factor is the number of times articles in that journal are cited elsewhere. So the New England Journal of Medicine had, even better than JAMA, the New England Journal of Medicine had the best shot that this article would be picked up and repeated elsewhere. So I thought, what have I got to lose? All I can do is say no. And heaven knows I've pitched enough articles. I've published my first article in 1979. So I pitched it to the New England Journal of Medicine. They responded that they would be interested in, no promises, but they would be interested in seeing the completed piece. So it took months to write it because it had to be exactly right. And what I wanted to show was three things. First, I wanted to show the data, and by now there were over 100 articles. I wanted to show the data that the medical literature in this field shows that single people, unmarried people, are less likely to survive cancer. And also that literature shows beyond any question that they're not getting the same treatment. The second thing I wanted to show was the biased reasons that those medical authors suggested for that disparity. They're essentially, they were saying it's the patient's fault. The doctors are doing the right thing by not giving this more aggressive treatment to single people because the single people in reality would not be able to handle it. And oh, by the way, they're also more likely to be alcoholic and more depressed and a variety of other things, either without any documentation or grossly misusing the sources they were citing. The third thing I wanted to show was that that information was in fact incorrect. For example, the one about single people are more likely to be depressed. The definitive information on that comes out of the United States Preventive Task Force. And they state in so many words, they don't even include marital status as the top differences in depression. It's gender, women are more likely to be depressed. They don't even include marital status at the top of the list. And they state you can't tell from someone's, whether someone is a man or a woman, whether they're depressed or not. And very importantly, there is extensive good psychological and sociological literature showing that there is not a relationship between whether you are married and whether you have social support, which was the backbone of what these medical articles were claiming. In reality, 45% of the American adult population is not married. 45%. 45% of American adults can't possibly all be pathetic loners up to our knees in cats. So clearly, this was a reflection of the bias in our culture. I think about what's in movies. You know, It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart. Oh, the poor librarian, she didn't get married. She ended up being a poor, lonely spinster. We keep seeing that all the time, and doctors are not immune to it. So those were the points I wanted to make from the New England Journal of Medicine. And I also wanted to argue that journal editors and peer reviewers need to do a lot better job than they've been doing, sorting out the authors, the medical authors' professional opinions about what they know about, what they have credentials in, and they're just spouting their personal social beliefs. So I wrote it up, I sent it in. I have never seen an editorial process like that. I've published, without exaggeration, at least 100 articles, probably more. I've never seen anything like that. There were six different editors. There was an editor that did nothing but check to make sure that the links went through. They were in touch with me repeatedly, and eventually it got published. And I'm happy to say it has been cited. It was published in September 2019, which means that articles that were published in 2020 would already have been in the pipeline by that time. But starting in 2021, about a third of the articles that are now published on marital status and cancer care cite my article, and for the first time they are acknowledging it could be physician bias that's affecting treatment.
Well, we're talking about cancer. We're talking about one disease, cancer. This systemic undertreatment of single patients is in just about any care that would mean that you might have to depend on someone to either give you a ride or help you out of bed for the first 2 or 3 days. I mean, even with, you know, let's say a knee replacement or a hip, we're not talking about huge surgeries. We're talking about and diseases that you may not recover from. The systemic biases that are out there for single people are absolutely, it's appalling. It's absolutely appalling because we're still living in the 50s, although we're not living in the 50s. In fact, we're getting some of our rights being taken away from us, which, you know, is scary enough. But put on top of that, the fact that we could be denied or maybe pointed in the wrong direction. And, you know, one of the things that you usually do is you pick a doctor that you trust. A doctor is supposed to be someone who you rely on because they have the information. And yet they have not been taught how to treat the whole patient, which is talking to the patient, getting to know the patient, what their life is like. You can't just yes, you can diagnose a broken bone, but if you're going to fix it, you should know about the patient and what their, you know, what their surroundings are, what their support system is. And that is not, as you said, and I'm very adamant about that, is, you know, a spouse, a child, a brother, a sister, it doesn't matter. I mean, I'm lucky I have a large family and I have 2 children who they know, you know, I'm their mama. But a support system is just that, a support system, and come from anywhere.
Well, I think one thing they're not taking into account, I mentioned before, you know, you could have a spouse who's unable to drive.
Yes.
But even among younger people, a lot of younger people have these gig economy jobs where they don't get paid if they don't work. So if one spouse is sick, how is the other one supposed to take off work and stay home with them all day or keep driving them to radiation appointments? You can't assume a spouse, however willing they may be. You can't assume
exactly
that person necessarily can do this. And you can't assume that other people won't. If you think about the way stories appear in newspapers, you know, all of this is under the level of consciousness. It's messages that we constantly receive, and we form these implicit biases. We don't even recognize them as biases. Think about the way stories appear. There's a car accident. First thing it says is a wife and mother of 2 was killed in a car accident. Well, if she weren't married or if she didn't have kids, would it be okay if she got killed in the car accident? But we keep hearing that message over and over. It, you know, it's obvious where it comes from in terms of historical roots, where, you know, the family or even the tribe. But today, think about how people live today. A friend of mine, Bella DiPaolo, who's a pioneer in the research, she has a PhD in psychology from Harvard. She's a pioneer in the research of single life. And she wrote a book called How We Live Now, in which she showed a lot of different lifestyles that people have that are not the old Dick and Jane readers, mommy and daddy and a white picket fence. People don't live near their immediate family. They move for jobs. They may be alienated in some way. She also, by the way, just published a book called Single at Heart about people who choose to be single, because in our culture, that's such a foreign concept, even today.
Oh, totally.
That anyone, but especially a woman, genuinely doesn't want a life partner. So people, there's a Facebook page that Bella DiPaolo started called the Community of Single People, mainly for people who are happy being single. And over, younger women especially say, I tell people I'm very happy living on my own. I want to live independently. I don't want a partner. And the response is, don't worry, dear, it's not too late. You're so pretty. You'll find somebody. It's as if you never said anything.
Because it's not the way we were brought up. It's not what society says that we should be doing. A woman needs to get married. A woman needs a partner to take care of themselves. A woman needs. Well, a woman doesn't.
And you know what? The research very clearly shows there's tons of research on this. Marriage benefits men much more than it benefits women in terms of health. Study after study shows that marital status will predict health outcomes or be associated with health outcomes for men much more than for women. A woman's marital status is almost irrelevant, whereas for a man, marital status is very important in terms of health outcomes.
Again, it's trying to make our minds up for ourselves instead of looking at the person and saying, gee, look at them, they're happy. They're not in an awful marriage, or they're not in a marriage that, you know, they didn't want to be in. That's not what they want. And people who are married, they don't want to be single. There are women who don't want to have children. Well, isn't that great that that's what they've decided instead of bringing a child into the world that they really are not set up to do? It's not what they want. We make decisions and we have to live by our decisions, and hopefully we're happy living by our decisions. But to have this stigma and to be disassociated and have this bias against where you can actually, your life is dependent on it. It's beyond words, really. Joan, what are you doing now to put the word out?
A few things. I'm working on a book. I have an editor who is interested. No guarantees yet.
There are no guarantees.
Never. But it's a good press. And I'm working on a proposal. The book will be it'll start with what we were talking about, differential in cancer care, but it will be a combination of health issues facing people who do not have current spouses, much of which actually will apply to some married people whose spouse can't fulfill the role that is expected. But it's even things like insisting that you have a ride to a procedure when you're not having a general anesthetic and there's really no reason you couldn't have driven yourself or taken a cab. Very importantly, our medical system does not provide the kind of aftercare it should provide. No. So you go in for a procedure, they throw pills at you, they throw you out the door when you're not even able to function by yourself, and you're supposed to somehow have a support system that deals with that. Again, even married people, what's a married person supposed to do if your spouse can't take off work or if your spouse needs more help than you do? And there's no aftercare provided. The insurance companies don't want to pay for rehab. You're supposed to have all these, essentially, it's supposed to be the way the ideal was in the 1950s. I was there in the 1950s. It wasn't even like this then. But the ideal was that you were supposed to have these, essentially, women who didn't go out to work. Yes. So it'd be your spouse, your mother, your sisters, your aunts, your female cousins, all this body of women who did not work outside the home, who would come and do all these things. But now that doesn't exist anymore, and yet the medical profession still has the illusion, still operates on the illusion that it does. So another thing we need is affordable transportation to medical procedures and affordable aftercare if you need to have someone stay with you for a few hours till the anesthesia wears off. We really need to stop assuming that everybody can provide that out of their own independent personal lives. And we need to stop assuming that the ability to provide that is synonymous with the having a spouse in the house.
Joan, I want to thank you for talking with me today about something that is not just important, but is information that people need to know. You know, we don't always think of these things. And, you know, for anyone listening, one of the most important things to me is something that, you know, that we talked about is when you go in to see a doctor, stop with the multi-choice, you know, multiple choice. You got to start telling them who you are. And that's so important. Joan, thank you so much. Is there someplace where people can get in touch with you? Is there
I have a website. It's very easy to find. It's joandelfatoremyname.com. Also, people are welcome to email. It's jdel@udel.edu. I'm also on Facebook under Joan Delfatore. I gave up on X.
Oh, Joan, thank you so much for being here with me today. And this has been wonderful. It's been so informative. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me today. If you liked what you heard, please share it with another person you think would be interested. And if you haven't already, please subscribe.
This has been a Life of Prey production.